Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey guys, it's Steve. I just want to let you know that it's basically impossible to talk about the movie 2012 without dropping a few F-bombs here and there. So if you've got kids in the car, you might want to put the earmuffs on right about now.
Scott Weinberg is a veteran film critic. Steven DeGennaro is a doctor of astrophysics. Listen in as these two nerds compare and contrast two noteworthy sci-fi films every week. They'll discuss the artistic quality of the films, whether they get the science right, and whether or not that even matters. Welcome to Science vs. Fiction.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Science vs. Fiction, the show in which a film critic and a doctor of astrophysics argue about movies and who is smarter. My name is Scott Weinberg. I am the film critic. This is my co-host, Dr. Steven DeGennaro.
Hello, everybody.
Steven, why don't you tell our listeners what we are here to discuss this episode?
I am so excited about this week's matchup because these are two of my two favorite disaster movies of all time, even though they are nothing alike whatsoever. Oh. And those two movies are 2009's 2012 by Roland Emmerich, and the Norwegian disaster film and Oscar shortlist contender, The Wave, a.k.a. Bølgen. I don't think I pronounced that right, but...
from a few years back, yeah. And, you know, Steven makes almost all of the matchups. I throw out a lot of suggestions, and then I kind of cede to him, because if I were to make the matchups, I would probably lean into all sorts of very specific movie nerd directions, but I want Steven to kind of match them up thematically or scientifically, and that's what he did, because this film does, of course, feature voluminous tidal waves, among also earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, what else? Bird flocking, the dissolution, the destabilization, the displacement of the Earth's crust, Stephen?
It basically is you take every disaster movie ever made and you stick them in a blender and you turn it up to 15 and then you have Roland Emmerich's 2012.
I grew up with a different filmmaker's disaster films. And that filmmaker was, of course, Irwin Allen. Directed a few, mostly known as a producer. And as a kid, it was a big deal when The Towering Inferno or The Poseidon Adventure were on television. That was a big deal for our family. My mom and dad loved those movies. And my sister and I would be allowed to stay up late. And if you know, my parents were usually pretty strict about bedtime. And when they would let you stay up late for a certain movie, that meant something. And it's probably and partially why I'm such a passionate movie nerd is because psychologically speaking, I connect being able to stay up late with the act of watching a movie. So therefore, it's a pleasure principle thing. Steven, do you think that my psychological theory holds any water?
I am not a psychologist, but I play one on TV, and so I will say yes.
Steven, can I ask you this? Is psychology a science?
Psychology is a social science.
Okay.
Which some people consider a science.
All right. And oh, take that, psychologists.
It is distinguished from what we in the business call hard sciences. So social sciences, things like economics, history, psychology, anthropology, those kinds of things are different from chemistry and physics and astronomy and hard sciences.
Something I've always wanted to bring up, and I've saved it. We're a half dozen episodes in. How often, when you explain to people what you've studied, do they think you mean astrology?
Probably 50% of the time, they say astrology when they're talking about it. So the number of people that think it is probably even higher than that.
Okay, so let me ask you this: is astrology a science?
No.
Oh. That's it. We just got booted off iTunes. We're going to get hated. Oh, my God. Reddit is going to start forums about us. We are anti-astrology. Wow.
It is what we call a pseudoscience.
All right. But a pseudoscience is still a science. All right. Speaking of pseudoscience, let us briefly discuss the filmography of one Roland Emmerich. Movie fans will remember him, his debut, 1992's Universal Soldier, a modest hit, then Stargate, I would say a double off the wall, to use the baseball analogy. Steven, you are a baseball fan, correct?
No, I'm not.
But you know what a double off the wall is. That's all I'm
saying. I do know what a double off the wall
is. Okay. And then that solid success of Stargate led to Fox hiring him for Independence Day. And that blew up. Then that led to 1998's Godzilla, which was a debacle, an atrocious film. And while it did make some decent coin, not nearly as much as was expected. Despite that failure, Sony hired him again a year later to make The Patriot, which is the only, as far as I'm concerned, the only historical drama based on a coloring book I have yet to locate.
It's basically, what if Braveheart, but if in America?
Yes, exactly. And Stephen, is there any science in The Patriot that we could get into? Maybe those, the firearms?
I will find some just so we can cover it.
All right. And then he took a vacation. 4 years later, he came back and did The Day After Tomorrow for Fox. Day After Tomorrow, Steve, give us a quick recap. What's that?
What if Independence Day, but global warming instead of aliens?
Right. We are. It features a wonderful scene in which I believe it's Jake Gyllenhaal is literally running from cold. He's running from cold.
Not just one. There are multiple scenes in that movie of people running from cold.
Right. As if you could stay 40 feet or 20 feet or 8 feet ahead of a cold snap. Oh, my God. Makes no sense.
We will definitely get to that one at some point.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. And then he took another 3 years off and came back in 2008 with 10,000 BC. Yeah. Let's move on. That led directly to this. 2012, and who else but the reigning king of cinematic, let's call it...
awesomeness?
What, disaster carnage, okay?
This was the culmination of his entire career up to this point.
I'm just drawing a blank here, because it's barely a movie, and yet it's so much movie. All right, why don't you, I want to turn it over to the layman as far as film analysis goes. Give us the plot, if you would, Stephen, of 2012.
John Cusack plays a schlubby dad who has a couple of kids that live with his ex-wife and her new husband, and he takes them on a trip to Yosemite where he discovers Chiwetel Ejiofor.
You had it right the first time.
Chiwetel Ejiofor. I made myself a pronunciation guide and everything.
And I will say, it is a difficult name to pronounce, but considering that he is probably the only person in this entire film earning his fucking paycheck, we are going to pronounce his name properly. Chiwetel Ejiofor. I love the guy.
So John Cusack comes across two people. One of them is Woody Harrelson, who plays a crackpot. And Chiwetel Ejiofor, who plays a scientist, both of which have the same theory, which is that the Earth is destabilizing from the inside out and there's going to be massive disasters everywhere, which proceed to then happen for the next 2.5 hours.
Right. But what is it that causes the Earth mantle or the Earth's core to start percolating microwave style?
Neutrinos.
All right. At the top, I think we could put it into our episode notes, or I'm going to put it up on Twitter. I had a massive note page. I usually take notes when I'm doing a podcast movie. And on this podcast, what I do is I draw a line horizontally across the middle of the page. And on the top is science topics for Steven. And on the bottom is movie nerd shit for me. And that's basically the note-taking process on science versus fiction. And the very top word for Steven is capital N, neutrino. What is a neutrino?
So, neutrinos are real. They are a real subatomic particle. They are part of the panoply of subatomic particles that exist in the world. There are the ones that you probably learned about in high school or middle school, the protons, neutrons, and electrons. Those form atoms. Neutrinos are these little tiny particles that mostly appear during some sort of nuclear reaction. So either, you know, an atom bomb here on Earth, or of course the nuclear reactions that are taking place in the heart of the sun. Now, the thing about neutrinos that makes them sort of interesting for scientists to study is that they interact almost not at all with what we call baryonic matter, which is normal matter, which is, you know, atoms, electrons, protons, neutrons, the stuff that you and I are made of, the stuff that the Earth is made of.
And the film, and not to interrupt, Doc, but they even make reference to that. One of the scientists says it's reacting to physical matter. And Chiwetel says that's not possible. So yes, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So that's normally not possible. So like the sun outputs trillions of neutrinos every second. Most of them are passing through your body as we speak. They literally just go right on through. They don't get stopped. They don't get like nothing. They just fly on through.
Not my body. Nope. Have you ever heard of people who can't eat gluten or lactose?
I have.
That's me. I am neutrino intolerant.
I don't like neutrinos, and I won't stand for them.
I will not have them passing through my physical form. How dare you? What is this dark magic you're talking about? I thought you were a scientist.
So the cool thing about neutrinos, so neutrinos were predicted theoretically first. And people were like, yeah, you just kind of made up this thing because the equations didn't balance out and you couldn't figure out where this extra mass was going to when you slammed two hydrogen atoms together. So what is this neutrino thing that you just invented? So they were postulated theoretically by Wolfgang Pauli, who's a theoretical physicist. And then it was only later on that we actually realized that, okay, these things actually exist. Now, the detectors thing that they show very early on in the movie, there's like a giant tank of water. That's basically the only way that we have to detect neutrinos. You have to have this giant, giant, giant tank of water, you know, and it may stop one neutrino out of every several trillion, you know, and then you can detect that. And so, like, they interact very, very weakly with matter.
But that poses a question. I want to ask a real science question. How would you go about if you wanted to intentionally collect neutrinos? What would you do?
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's what they do. That's what a neutrino detector is a giant vat of water that occasionally gets hit by a neutrino.
So how many neutrinos do you think you could catch in your kid's backyard pool?
0.00000. I don't know. I'd have to look up the exact number, but lots of zeros and then a one.
Okay.
So neutrinos, like I said, like the movie says, normally do not interact with normal matter. For whatever reason, because Mayans or something, neutrinos have started interacting with normal matter, and they open up the top of this tank and they realize that all the water is boiling. And he says, oh, they're acting like microwaves. And that's the first clue that, like, wait, what? Because if they were acting like microwaves, it wouldn't just be the water in the tank that they're standing on that's boiling. It would be all of the water in their bodies.
It would be cooking everything.
It would. The oceans would boil.
And here's a question. It's boiling. I assume it's a mega giant tank, as you said. And he has this really hardcore latch that he has to what is that door called?
He says it goes down 6 miles or something.
Right,
like
right. And here's my question. How did he know that when he opened that hatch, it wasn't going to just explode everywhere white hot water?
Well, it would if it were boiling and it's in a closed container.
Exactly.
Then yes, the minute he opened it, steam would have burned all of them.
All right, good. So I wasn't crazy on that. Okay.
Oh, no. Great. The science in this movie is absolute garbage, but that's part of its charm, in my opinion.
Okay. So let me ask you this. What do you think that the screenwriter's connection is from aberrant neutrinos to microwaving items within the Earth's core? What is the connection?
I guess probably the thought process is neutrinos being one of the only things that can pass through ordinary matter that comes from the sun and can pass through ordinary matter without necessarily interacting with things on the surface, that you'd have to use neutrinos for that. So I guess the hand-wavy science is the neutrinos come out of the sun, they pass through us, they pass through the Earth's crust, and then they get caught in the Earth's core, and that heats up the Earth's core, and that causes all the rest of the shit.
The connection is then, I'll have to break it into layman's terms, the connection is that since neutrinos can pass through solid matter, that is, in theory, how it is cooking items within the Earth's core, but yet not cooking the things on the way to the Earth's core.
Exactly.
Okay, and if I could bring just a little horror, old school horror into this, the whole concept of things from another, not necessarily dimension, but another form of matter passing through hard matter sounds a lot like H.P. Lovecraft's From Beyond.
Neutrinos are definitely sort of spooky when you stop and think about them because, again, they are literally everywhere. There are thousands of them passing through your head at this very moment, and they are doing nothing. It's like a whole parallel universe that exists, you know, that we can't see, we can't detect, and it's just there. It's almost like a ghost dimension.
Did Lovecraft, in a way, sort of predict neutrino waves?
It's possible. That dude had some seriously spooky shit going on in his brain. So,
all right, Stephen, and just to ask, just to cover this because it's briefly thrown out in the movie, how does a microwave work?
like a microwave meaning the wave of energy, or a microwave meaning the thing that you cook your food in?
How does a microwave work, and in relation to the lovely appliance we all have in our kitchen?
So a microwave is just another form of electromagnetic radiation. So the same thing as light, X-rays, gamma rays. These are all electromagnetic radiation. They're all formed by the same thing, which is charged particles moving around.
Or love. I believe electricity is generated by love. That's just my theory. And you can't – do not shit on my belief.
That was proven false in 1942 in the love experiment of 1942. Now, microwaves as a broad term – refers to a whole band of frequencies. When we talk about the microwaves that sort of your microwave oven emits, they are microwaves at a very specific frequency that what it does is it takes water molecules and it vibrates them, essentially. And by vibrating these water molecules at this very specific frequency, you know, when you vibrate something fast enough, it starts to heat up. And so that's essentially how a microwave works.
All right, but let's move back to the movie. But I got to ask you, because everybody who owns a microwave must wonder this, why does metal explode in a microwave? Because it has no moisture?
No, because the electrons in metal are free to basically move around. So as the microwaves hit the metal, it moves the electrons back and forth at way faster speeds than it would the water molecules, and that causes electricity to generate in the piece of metal, and then you have a giant electrified piece of metal that you're heating up.
You know what? I thought I found this very interesting, Stephen. Did you happen to note who co-wrote this film with Roland Emmerich?
I believe that it was Harold Closer.
And if you check on his filmography, what you realize is the man is a career composer. And then all of a sudden, he co-wrote 10,000 BC and he co-wrote this.
Which just goes to show you, anybody can write a fucking awesome movie if they have the talent to do so.
Okay, Stephen, I know you are not a geologist, but talk a bit about the main villain, the main villain of this movie, despite the causes and ripple effects. The main villain of this movie is the displacement of Earth's crust. It causes Yellowstone to erupt in a volcanic eruption. It causes Los Angeles to completely fall into the ocean. And it leads to tsunamis, earthquakes.
Basically everything awesome.
Yeah, okay. The Earth's crust, talk about it.
Well, I mean, the Earth's crust we call it the crust for a reason, right? The Earth, most of the Earth is molten. It's just liquid rock. That's the lava, the magma that then comes out as lava out of volcanoes. It forms islands. It does all of that kind of stuff. So you have these plates of stuff, basically like, if you heat up a cup of milk, how it forms a little like the layer on top of like that's kind of solid that you could then poke with your finger.
Yep.
Like that's basically the Earth's crust. So we're floating around on this giant liquid rock ocean essentially. And I guess, if in the physics of the movie, if you heated up the inside of the Earth enough, that would start to destabilize the crust and would cause all the plates to move and volcanoes to explode.
So it's like, all right, let's use another food analogy. You and I are standing on a giant stale pie, and then somebody shoots a laser into the center of the pie, and as the pie heats up, we start to sink into the hot, hot cherry.
Exactly. Couldn't have said it better myself.
Oh, my God. Okay, so I know it's not good form to try and start your own running gags. They should take effect naturally, but I think what we want to do is have a running tally of every time one of these movies mentions Einstein, because in this movie, the Earth crust destabilization or displacement theory, and they say in the film, although a kook says it, Woody Harrelson, that Einstein believed in this theory.
Oh yeah, but he's a kook. He also thought that Marilyn Monroe was assassinated by the CIA. So like, you're taking his word for it. He does turn out to be right about pretty much everything. So maybe, I don't know, maybe he's right. But as far as I'm aware, the scientist that he cites for that, and I don't recall the name off the top of my head, is not actually a real person.
Oh!
And so therefore, I don't think Einstein could have ever actually supported this theory.
That's awesome, because I almost jotted that name down to ask you about them, but no, it was fabricated for the film by Roland Emmerich and his longtime composer. Great. a good section of this movie is people running from ash clouds, debris. You have anything scientific to say about an ash cloud?
It's a cloud of ash. I mean, no. What I love about this movie, it dials everything up to 15 at least, if not 20.
All right, we're going to switch. Can I put on my film critic hat instead of my science junior science student?
Sure. So
hat.
So I can explain to you why you're wrong.
Why is this not a comedy?
It is a comedy. It's fucking hilarious.
It is not a comedy. No, it is not. It is a dumb drama.
This is the problem. This is why you don't understand this movie and don't enjoy this movie. This movie is self-parody. It's clearly Roland Emmerich having a fucking ball, making fun of his own fucking oeuvre of movies and just going, you know what?
I do not agree.
I'm throwing everything in here. I'm making the fucking disastriest disaster movie of all goddamn time. Dude, this movie is hilarious. There is so much.
I will concede that a good portion of it is meant to be funny. But there's a scene, for example, that amounts to absolutely nothing but costs clearly a shitload of money, where a grocery store breaks in half. And right before the floor cracks open and two of our secondary characters are split apart, the guy looks at her and says, "I feel like we're drifting apart."
How do you not understand that that's comedy?
I do. No, I understand that the attempt at humor is intentional, but it's so not funny. It's so not funny.
Oh, but it is so funny because it's so the kind of thing that a person in a bad disaster movie would say.
But yet, that scene amounts to nothing because both of those characters survive. Miraculously, nobody died while a giant fissure opened up in the middle of a supermarket, which I'm sorry, would be a carnage bloodbath galore. It just would.
It was destruction porn. I mean, like, why does that shit happen in Earthquake 1970, whatever?
All right, I have a science question you might not see coming. What are the mathematical odds that Chiwetel Ejiofor has read a book that sold 422 copies and then meets the author?
And then the author ends up on the boat where he is. No, that's, again, this is one of the things that this is part of the intentional comedy of the thing, right? This entire movie is driven by one coincidence after another after another. It happens to be that he goes to vacation in Yellowstone and he ends up meeting both Chiwetel Ejiofor and Woody Harrelson. Yeah. It just so happens that he happens to be the driver for this Russian oligarch who has a ticket onto the Ark.
I'm sorry. Wait, hold on. From stem to stern, that whole Russian oligarch character has got to go. That is a...
I love him. He's so good.
At one minute, like, he's rotten. He's rotten.
They
make him a little bit... You're like, oh, he's not so bad after all. He cares about his boys. No, rotten again, rotten.
And his kids are rotten, too.
Oh, God. I hated all of that. And it's just...
And then he's got the little arm candy wife who apparently got her boobs done at Tom McCarthy's office because he's a plastic surgeon.
The Russian oligarch's girlfriend, not wife, the Russian oligarch's girlfriend got her boobs done, and the doctor is now John Cusack's, Amanda Peet's new husband.
Amanda Peet's husband, right, and Amanda Peet is John Cusack's ex-girlfriend.
In this movie's version of there are 40 people who live.
And there's no reason for that. It doesn't actually, like, that particular coincidence doesn't even drive any story points. It's just, he turns at one point and they recognize each other.
I can explain that. That's a shortcut in screenwriting where if two characters who don't know each other and then they look across at each other and they go, oh, he's my dentist. And he says, oh, yeah, let me see your teeth. Oh, you look great. Then we both have established like a little bit more character there.
Right.
They know each other from the past. And even though it's nominal, it's something, you know.
Right. Well, it gives them a reason to care about each other as opposed to just complete strangers, I suppose.
All right. Another piece of science that pops up in this movie, and I have it written in brackets on my notes. The poles have been reversed. Steven,
that's true.
Can the North and the South
absolutely.
Pole? Okay, well, wait. Let
in
me
fact,
get that.
Not only is it true, it
can
has
I get
happened.
The question out?
Okay, go ahead.
Is that possible? Can the poles reverse, and what would happen?
The poles reverse every few thousand years, in fact. What we think of as North and South have not been, in terms of the magnetic poles. I mean, if you went out with a compass 30,000 years ago, it would point in a totally different direction than it would point today. The magnetic poles, for reasons that we don't entirely understand, they switch. Our magnetic field gets weaker and stronger occasionally, and sometimes it gets so weak that it goes to zero, and then it switches to being in the opposite direction. Totally true. Totally happens.
Does it have something to do with the theory of, like, just simple rotation? You know, like, you spin something 1,000 ways in left, and then it's going to, not 1,000 degrees right, but it's going to give back a relatively equal amount of force until it reverses again.
Well, so I think the leading theories are something like that. So, what causes the Earth's magnetic field, as far as we know, is that the core of the Earth is rotating. I mean, obviously the entire Earth is rotating, but the core of the Earth in particular, which is made out of mostly iron and nickel, is rotating. And anytime you take something that has electric charge in it and you rotate it fast enough, it creates a magnetic field. And so, yes, there are some theories that maybe the core of the Earth is sort of wobbly, and so it's not always necessarily rotating in the same direction. But the truth is, we honestly really don't understand. Like, we don't know what causes them to switch.
I don't need "we don't understand." You're a freaking scientist. Do your job.
We don't understand.
We don't understand the poles. Good God. How?
First rule of being a science communicator is admitting when we don't understand something.
Well, you know what? That's the last rule of being a film critic. All right, now I'm going to switch over because I really sincerely do not like this movie. It was a fucking chore to sit through. But I will give it fair due, and I will do so enthusiastically in one regard. The digital effects in this movie are freaking amazing.
They're so good. They're so good. I mean, that's, again, it's destruction porn. You're like, you can't, like, what more do you want?
I know, but that's like, but okay, Steven, if you have three or four scenes of landscape carnage, which is just cities falling into the ocean and giant buildings and people and trucks and subway trains and planes falling into the ground. And those sequences are stunning and amazing. And they make up, I don't know, 15, 18% of your movie. And the spectacle is amazing. And then virtually everything else around it is tiresome and dull. I don't care so much about that 15, 18% that is eye-popping and legitimately impressive.
Okay, so first of all, saying that it is anywhere near 15 to 18%, I think is a gross misunderestimation of just how much destruction porn there is in this movie.
Well, no, all right, no. Let's break it down this way. There are two phenomenal sequences in this movie where Tom McCarthy as the new husband and Amanda Peet and all the main characters are taking off in a plane.
I gotta say that this is after he drives through Los Angeles as the street is crumbling underneath him and buildings are falling, almost falling on top of the car and whatever else. Like, that's...
Yeah, that sequence is pretty solid. I like the two plane sequences, especially the first one, because that's where they're just like, all right, you could see Roland Emmerich saying, these are the five big set pieces we have. Now, how do we get him on the street? How do we get him into the plane? How do we get him into the second cargo plane? How do we get, you know, it's like, how do we get these characters into these action set pieces?
And they did it perfectly and seamlessly. Go figure.
All right. My problem with it is, while those action sequences and set pieces and carnage are legitimately impressive, when they're over, I feel like we're just like, on a dead stop.
See, I don't agree. I think, first of all, John Cusack can carry any fucking movie that he's in, first of all.
I like him a lot in a lot of things, and he's not bad here, but there's not enough character there. His one character trait is that he wrote a book in which a character sacrifices himself nobly at the end, which we know is going to come up later, but since it's a Hollywood movie, we're going to get a different ending.
We're going to make the stepdad sacrifice himself. No.
Oh, and he's complete. I love it. Tom McCarthy character, stepdad, they write him out like a smarmy dick.
No, they don't.
And then they waver.
Nice. He's like a lovable goofball. Are you kidding? Right from the very beginning.
No.
Oh, come on. He is a lovable goofball. He is a dude. It's Tom McCarthy. Every part that Tom McCarthy plays, he's a lovable goofball. I want to do a little quick sidebar here and just say that Tom McCarthy is one of my absolute favorite filmmakers of all time.
He's a great writer.
He made like The Station Agent,
yep.
The Visitor,
yep.
Win-Win,
yeah, but
Spotlight. Like, Jesus, dude, make a couple good movies. How about?
He's written a lot of good things. I like him a lot better as a filmmaker as I do as an actor. He's just very... Let's blame Emmerich, but he's just very bland.
Oh, I love
he's
him.
Very dull.
I love him. He's just a lovable goofball. He's the perfect stepdad character because he's not an asshole. He's not, you know, like, oh, I'm replacing you and your family, blah, blah, blah. And, like, they don't try to set up this dumb dynamic that they always do in movies with stepdads and real dads.
I don't know. I think he is kind of a jerk.
There's a little bit of it. I mean, it's, well, whatever. Again, I don't think Tom McCarthy could act like a jerk if, you know, if you injected
him. Dude, they're in the supermarket. They're in the supermarket, and he's like, what kind of, how could you ever be with him? How many books did he sell? 500?
He's got a point.
That's mean. Okay, he's not a nice guy. But I will give him this. He saves them with his allegedly meager flying skills, and then he falls into a gear and dies. The kids never ask what happened to him, and Amanda Peet, 5 minutes later, is hugging up on her ex, John Cusack again.
You have to get rid of the stepdad in order to get the family back together. This is screenwriting 101, Scott. Come on.
All right. I got one. I got one that you're going to have to agree with me on. I got one.
If it's a negative about this movie, then no.
The D or the E story. I don't know what you'd call it, but it's the two old men on the freaking cruise ship.
That's my favorite part of the entire movie is those two old guys. I love them.
Oh, it's so mean. It is so mean-spirited. One of these old musicians on a cruise ship, he's the dad of Chiwetel and gets to have this great, heroic, sweet moment where he talks and has this heroic moment and he says, goodbye, dad, and they have this great moment. And then they have a mirror image scene later on with George Segal where he hasn't talked to his son because George Segal is apparently a racist asshole and he's about to talk to his estranged son after however many years. And his house caves in and he dies. Friday the 13th movies that are less mean than this movie. This movie, okay, here's another one. The arm candy girlfriend, she turns out to be pretty fucking brave and heroic. And what happens to her? She drowns in a cell alone. Why? It's mean. This is a mean-spirited movie, dude.
Dude, there's nothing mean about this movie. It doesn't have a mean bone in its body. I don't.
Let me ask you this. Watch the Woody Harrelson performance in this movie when he's standing at the top of a mountain, hooting and hollering as lava balls crash his face open. And now watch that performance and repeat to yourself, this guy's going to win an Oscar in a few years.
And it shows. I mean, like, what?
It's, dude, I love Woody Harrelson, and this might be one of his goofiest, silliest performances ever.
I would not disagree with that in any way, shape, or form whatsoever. But again, goofy and silly is the entire point of this movie. So, like, if you're not into goofy and silly, then I suppose, it's you know.
But you have, all these action scenes, and what do we have to wedge in there? Chiwetel, okay, he's good. John Cusack and his family barely escape. Dandy Newton does virtually nothing. She has a cursory subplot about art being placed somewhere, and I don't even know.
She's also the president's daughter.
Right. Another wild coincidence. It's just, I don't like this movie.
Dude, Danny Glover is like the most dignified president ever portrayed on film.
I love, he's dignified, he's helping all the little man, and the giant ash cloud comes, he gets knocked out, he wakes up covered with ash, everybody else is dead, he looks up, and a literal battleship falls on him! A literal battleship falls on
the president of the United States. The last president of the United States, as he points out.
Oh my.
So
how many people do you think die in this movie?
All of them. I will tell you, if you want me to say some negatives about this movie, I will point out two negatives, and then I think probably we should move on to the next movie because we're way over time here. But so two things that I didn't like on this watch. One is that Chiwetel's dad, who's the musician on the ship, after he says goodbye to him, he turns to this waiter and he's like, give me a drink. And George Segal is like, but you haven't had a drink in 25 years. And he's like, I don't care. And he drinks anyway. That kind of bugged me because it's like, you know what? If you've been sober for 25 years, you probably just want to go out sober. You know, like at that point, you're not, you know, I can understand sort of this. I don't know. To me, like that just felt like, oh man, that makes me sad. So that's one moment I didn't like. The only other thing that I didn't like was at the very end, and I had forgotten this, the entire Earth basically gets destroyed in destruction porn. And they discover in the last 5 minutes of the movie, when they're on these giant arcs that are floating on the ocean, that the only place that was spared was Africa. So now all of these white people are going to Africa to colonize it and take it over. And I'm like, man, maybe that's not the best image to be leaving the movie on.
Yeah, you got these arcs, which is something I guess we could get into because we covered this very briefly in Deep Impact. The idea of the Earth is about to die or get a horrible disaster, and we have to save animals.
Yep, and they're literally helicoptering giraffes and elephants across the Chinese mountains in the freezing cold to get them over to the arcs. And then it turns out Africa's fine. guess we didn't need to save the elephants and the giraffes after all.
Speaking of appropriation, how often are the Mayans even mentioned in this film?
I mean, they're mentioned 3 or 4 times. Oh, actually, so that was one of the other science things that I did want to talk about. So obviously the entire premise of this movie, And this is how you know that the movie is completely tongue-in-cheek, because they made the entire premise of the movie this ridiculous conspiracy. I don't even know what you would call it. That's not even a conspiracy theory. I don't even know what the hell it is. It's just this, it's just ridiculous. It's a ridiculous scientific calendarific sort of theory that because the Mayans, you know, ended up ending on 2012, the way that they built their calendar, it must mean that they thought the world was going to end then. Which is like saying, hey, my calendar only goes until December 31st, so therefore New Year's Day must be the end of the world. It was like, no, you right. start another calendar at that point.
Dude, you didn't know that the world ends every January 1st? The world begins anew. All right, report card time. On a scale of entertainment value, I give 2012 like a C. And that's literally for the special effects, Chiwetel, and sure, Cusack is fun a bit here and there as the beleaguered dad who cannot be killed. Sure. On scientific intelligence, D. They got gravity right, so I'll give them that. Steven?
I mean, on scientific intelligence, I would probably give it a triangle. It's just not even it's not even on the scale of letter grades. It's not. It's so far not the point of the movie that, like, I don't even care.
This is embarrassing, man. I feel like you're like complimenting Armageddon. I really hope none of your colleagues listen to this episode, man. This is embarrassing a little. It really is.
Dude, this movie makes Armageddon look like The Room.
Nova. I thought you were going the other way.
No. So, yeah. So I would give it, you know, like I said, I don't think it exists on the scientific scale. And on an artistic scale, I'm going to give it an A and one line of the plus, but not quite all the way to the plus, just because I got to save that for like the very best movies.
It's an A minus if you just give it a line, stupid.
Not if it's the vertical line.
A vertical line doesn't mean anything.
I'm going to give it an A plus. That's what it is. It's A plus.
Okay. All right. Well,
it's so ridiculous. It's craptastic. It is the definition. This movie, to me, is the Saving Private Ryan of disaster movies.
Oh.
It gets everything about disaster movies so perfectly right that there's really no point in anybody ever making another one, as far as I'm concerned. They're all just going to be compared to this as the high water mark.
Speaking of high water, Steven, we're going to move over to a much smaller but much more impressive film. It is called The Wave. It is a Norwegian film. It was Norway's submission for the Academy Awards in 2015. And I'm going to spoil everything and say, I freaking love this movie. But I want to know, Steven, there are lots of options out there for disaster movies. You could have picked an earthquake. You chose The Wave. Why is that?
Well, so two reasons. The first reason is because, like I said way back at the beginning of this episode, I love both of these movies unabashedly, and I think one of them is an example of completely over-the-top, ridiculous, defies all laws of physics, defies all laws of probability and logic, and is fun as hell. And the other one, The Wave, is super grounded, super realistic, very tense and scary and just like, it's the exact opposite of a kind of a disaster movie.
Yeah, it is a very interesting counterpoint. And I might have, if it was me left to my devices, I might have paired up 2012 against The Day After Tomorrow just to get them both out of the way. But no, I like the counterpoint because, it's a kind of a twist that you like 2012, kind of not a surprise that I don't. But it's cool to then turn onto a slightly smaller, well, not slightly, much smaller film that we both like very much. And I think it's an interesting counterpoint for this reason. The Wave is good for the reasons, in my opinion, that 2012 is bad. And it's because The Wave spends a good half hour setting up its characters and doing so not, I mean, it's a lot of it is, you know, Spielbergian type, easy domestic setup, small village surrounded by these wonderful, beautiful, but also very dangerous mountains. And all it would take is one big rockfall or avalanche, earthquake, call it what you will. Any kind of massive seismic event would cause a major tsunami to barrel down this valley and destroy the entire town. And it's kind of a cautionary disaster story because it is based on a real city in which this very well could happen.
Based on and shot in, yes. And not could happen. Has happened, although not to this extent, and scientists believe that it eventually will happen to this sort of extent.
What I like most about this film is that in 2.5 hours, 2012 only throws like cursory efforts at character development at the screen.
Well, so I would say that it has obviously very different ambitions.
And this film has simplistic characters, but well-drawn, well-hewn, well-crafted.
Well, yes. I mean, yes. The writing and the acting are obviously, in terms of the goals that they're trying to accomplish, are obviously much more realism, much more grounded characters, much more characters that you really sort of care about. Whereas 2012, in keeping with the theme of the entire movie, its characters are just as sort of ridiculous and broad and over-the-top as the action is. And for me, that works. For you, it doesn't. But it also works for me, absolutely, in this movie, that this family... It doesn't spend a whole lot of time trying to be like, oh, okay, there's, you know, these are all sorts of unique personalities or thing, you know, archetypes or things we haven't seen before. It's just a family, but it's so well written and it's so grounded and so well acted that you kind of just feel like you're being dropped into the middle of this real family. And that is what makes it work. It makes you care about them because you're just like, oh, I'm just kind of watching the lives of these people as they go about their lives.
And yeah, there's nothing particularly noteworthy about the guy, our two heroes, our husband and wife, and he's a geologist, she is a hotel manager, and obviously he's going to be central hero for much of the time because he's the geologist who starts to suspect that there might be an event coming soon. And of course, he's on his last day of work. Wink,
yes.
Wink.
Before they move out of the area and wouldn't even need to worry about this anymore.
Yeah, before they move out of the area completely. And, you know, again, not to belabor the point, but it's simple character building. None of them have to be like these caricatures or archetypes. They're just simply mom, dad, two kids, and they're all likable. And then, you know, this little domestic bubble is disrupted by a horrific natural disaster. Steven, let's talk a bit about the special effects in this movie.
I mean, you know, you talked about the CGI in 2012 being spectacular. Obviously, it's not on anywhere near the same scale. But given that this movie reportedly only cost under $7 million in U.S. dollars, it's pretty damn spectacular.
Yeah. Like you said, you know, there's a lot more destruction in the destruction of 2012. In 2012, you'll see 100 different things pop across the screen during 5 different sequences. In this, it's a big wall of water, and it's effective, though. You know, I mean, there's a great shot in this movie about halfway through where some survivors are trying to leave a hotel, and they're not able to, so they have to run back into the hotel. And we have this master shot from way back, and the wave is cresting on the left, and you could still see the little characters running back into the hotel on the right. And it's that kind of scale that you often lose in the Hollywood disaster movie. But I think that's part of a director's effort to actually flesh out the characters. The director of this film, and I'm going to try and pronounce it properly, Roar Uthog, who directed a great slasher film about 12 years ago called Cold Prey.
Of which there are clips in the wave.
Yeah, yeah.
They're watching it on a TV at one point.
Yeah, yeah. Check out, it's a whole trilogy. The first two are really good. Cold Prey, good stuff. And then after this, he got the Tomb Raider job, and I thought that was a pretty entertaining movie. And you could see where he would get that job based on the setup of the action scenes. Steven, what are the action bits or the set pieces?
Well, so yeah, I was going to say, you were talking about scale. Like, the scale of this movie is so much smaller, but not in a bad way at all. I mean, the scale of this is deliberately sort of, again, it's very grounded, it's very realistic. And the action sequences, you know, in contrast to 2012, where you like have John Cusack just driving a limousine, the ground literally disintegrating underneath him and bridges falling and whatever else, then it's all just, again, over the top. The tensest scene in this movie is literally a bunch of people running up a hill.
Oh, it's great.
Trying to escape the wave.
Yeah.
And the first time I saw this in the theater, I was just sitting there gripping my armrests during this entire sequence, and like my head, like you talk about it, it's almost a cliche at this point, but like it really was just like, holy crap, I forgot to breathe for like a minute, just like,
yeah,
because I was that into the story.
That really entertaining kind of, you're watching a movie and you're into it, and the editing and the score and the pacing, and you're doing that go, go, go. You know, and you're like really into the rhythm of the action bit or the set piece, you know, and this movie has a couple of those. And I thought it reminded me a bit of the ending in Deep Impact, where we have a bunch of characters running up a hill to avoid oncoming waves and waters. In that movie, you kind of have like, you know, you see a bunch of people running up a hill and then they're at the top of the hill. In this movie, there's like geography to it. They're running one way and then the road wraps back on itself and you can see different characters running up the hill. The geography of something as simple as several desperate people running up a hill is orchestrated much more cleverly and visually appealing in this movie than it was in Deep Impact.
Yeah, and you know, you also care about the characters that this stuff is happening to, and there are little individual, it's not just people running up a hill, there are little individual beats of that story. So they're driving up the hill, he has to stop because apparently, obviously everybody else is trying to drive up the hill. By the way, they have 10 minutes between when they hear the sirens and when they have to be up above, I think, 80 meters. And so the traffic is stopped, so he has to then make a decision, okay, do I stay in the car and hope that the car start moving, or do I get out of the car and I start running? And he obviously chooses to get out of the car and start running. He starts warning everybody else along the way, you got to run, you got to run. Like, everybody starts getting out of their cars. They come across this other family, their neighbors, and one of this other family ends up getting stuck, and he has to go back and try to save her. And there's just, like, there's little beats throughout this entire sort of sequence.
Our hero... his neighbor friend has her leg stuck between two cars. He leaves his daughter with the husband and says, take the kids and keep running up the hill. He goes back to help his friend. Then they get into more trouble, and she's a very minor character. I thought, I am now doubly invested in anything that happens to this guy and his family because this movie has shown me that he's willing to sacrifice his own safety for his neighbor. And 2012, there's not a lot of moments where characters reach out and try to help one another.
No.
And in this movie that's an hour shorter and on a much smaller scale, there are several moments where, I mean, even him just running up the hill telling 6, 7, 8 different characters, get out, run. And it's like, yeah, that's what a normal person would do. They would try and help everyone.
Yeah, and the performances are so good that you believe every second of everything that happens on screen in this movie. And that, to me, is... it's a thing that you lose a lot in disaster movies because, again, a lot of them are this sort of very broad archetypal characters and this very over-the-top action-y set piece, you know, the Rock jumping off of a crane into a building, and you lose all sense of physics and reality.
And we're jumping from a subplot 7 to subplot 4 to subplot 3. In this movie, there's the main family. The father and his younger daughter are probably 60% of the plot, and the mother and her son are probably 40% of the plot until they merge. The vast majority of the film is just cutting between an A story and a B story, whereas not just a Roland Emmerich, but like the San Andreas and those movies, they seem like in order to fill their running time in between set pieces, subplot L connects to subplot C, and it's just so yeah. much randomness, and this sticks to the family, and that's why it's so good.
Well, sometimes, you know, yeah, 4 characters that you care about are worth more than 12 characters that you half care about.
And I like, and I talk about this, Steve, it's not a dark film, but it does have a couple of dark moments you won't see coming, and it keeps you on your toes.
I definitely do not want to spoil this movie for people, so I guess I'll be a little bit vaguer, but there's a late death that happens that you don't see coming that is just devastating, and the way it's played keeps you on your toes the entire way through as to, like, is this character going to be okay, or are they not going to be okay?
Let's do this. A couple of science bits. One thing I really like about this movie, you don't see it a lot in disaster movies, but, you know, they show us the technicians working inside of the crevice to kind of read the sensors that will, you know, the whole, the entire thing is there to give the town a warning if there's going to be a major rock slide or an earthquake or anything horrible. And we get to go down into the crevice and see how that technology works. I'm sure it's not 100% accurate, but it's pretty believable in the context of the movie. Steven, now I know you're not a geologist, but what do you think about that aspect of the science in
well,
this movie?
Well, so, you know, I said, I'm not a geologist, but I can speak to sort of the way science is done generally. And one of the things I really liked was the production design of the control room, because it doesn't feel like this sort of futuristic, like, oh, we have mm-hmm. these, like, I mean, there are like 10 or 12 screens and they're all kind of flashing numbers in basically in a Windows system. And it looks exactly like the control room of a telescope looks. It looks exactly like the control room of almost any scientific endeavor. At one point, he walks in on the scientist playing solitaire, which is one of those details that, like, is meant, I think, to be a little bit humorous, but it also feels so true because there are so many, like, I played more Minesweeper and Hearts when I used to go out to the observatory than I did actual work. There's so much of science is just this downtime where you're just kind of sitting there waiting for stuff to come in.
I don't know if you want to keep that in the episode, if your teachers, your old instructors are going to listen.
No, but that's what I'm saying. This is part of science. Like, there's a lot of time where you're just kind of sitting there babysitting computers while they do the stuff, and you're there to sort of make sure things don't go wrong, and you're there to make sure that you're monitoring stuff. But a lot of times you're just kind of just sitting there, you're watching a movie, you're playing Minesweeper, and you've got one eye on the work, and you've got one eye on your play computer, And so that I felt was really, again, it's just a little detail that felt really realistic to me.
What can you tell us scientifically about these sensors, about these things that would be able to detect rock slides or tremors or earthquakes?
Well, from what I can tell, it looks like they're measuring the width of that crevice. So they have these bars in there that are measuring it down to, it looked like it was like 0.003 millimeters, which is an exceptionally accurate sort of thing. And they could see, okay, how is this thing getting bigger over time? And then one of the sort of main things about the movie that sort of sets off the plot is that, you know, all of their assumptions are that this thing is getting bigger and bigger, and eventually it's going to break off and it's going to fall into the ocean. But then all of a sudden it actually starts getting smaller. It starts contracting. And it's our hero, Christian, who realizes, wait a second, that means that this thing is about to happen. And he goes and looks up. Another interesting detail. He's back at home at this point, and he pulls out a bunch of scientific papers to look through to see if he can find, you know, information about what to do when the thing is contracting. And all of those scientific papers are in English, which I thought was also, again, a very sort of realistic touch, because generally speaking, most science is published in English, and most scientists, a lot of scientists come to America to study and then go back to their home countries. And English is kind of like the universal language of a lot of scientific study.
All right. One thing that always fascinates me when I see a movie about tsunamis or tidal waves, what can you tell our students about how that works? For example, when a, let's say, 50 tons of rock falls into the ocean or a small bay, how does that displacement actually work?
Well, I mean, you know, the same way that works if you do a cannonball into a swimming pool, like your body has mass and volume, and when you jump into a swimming pool, you displace an equal amount of water as...
Dude, your body has mass and volume.
Mine has more than most. But if you jump into a swimming pool, you displace the amount of volume that you take up. And so, you send ripples outward. So in this case, it's basically half of a mountain falls down into the water. And when it does, it displaces all of this water. And that water then has sort of nowhere to go but to form this giant wave that then propagates down the entire inlet and destroys these towns that are situated around it.
Yeah, I think... My question is, because obviously displacement is a relatively simple concept in science, but I think the scale of it, to people, I'll admit it, I have trouble grasping that kind of scale without, you know, even though I've seen these movies, I still have trouble grasping the concept of, because you hear about these, you know, these horrible floods that happened, you know, 200 years ago in small towns in Pennsylvania, and you think, I have trouble just... imagining that much rock hitting that much water and instantly creating that much energy. It's hard to grasp, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, rock is really, really heavy. So there's a whole lot of energy when it falls. You can go online and you can look up YouTube videos of like the Fukushima, the tidal wave that, you know, that caused the Fukushima disaster in Japan a couple years ago. Like real tidal waves, at least the ones that are out in the ocean, tend to be weirdly underwhelming in a way, especially if your only point of reference is disaster movies, like, because they move very, very slow, and you know, it's not necessarily this giant towering wall of water as it's always sort of portrayed in movies. It's just like, holy crap, the water's rising, it's rising, it's rising, it's rising, it's keep rising, you know, and the extent of the tidal wave is much wider than you think it's going to be, and so it takes a longer time to get up to like, okay, now this thing is super high. And I think in a way that makes them more dangerous, because people see the water rising and they don't really sort of see this giant wave coming at them, and they think, okay, well, the water's just getting a little bit higher and then it'll go down and I'll be fine. And it just kind of keeps going up and up and up. And it's way more powerful than you think it is, because again, water has a lot of mass, and so it can push things with a significant amount of force, especially, you know, then you channel that into a small gorge as opposed to over the entire coastline of Japan. And now you're talking about that same amount of energy in a much smaller area. And so you're going to end up with a bigger wave and a lot more destructive power to it.
Stephen, let's talk about the things that the wave doesn't have that 2012 does that make the wave better. I got one. I know you have another. The wave doesn't have, I already covered this real quickly, the silly cruise ship subplot. It doesn't have those extraneous character bits that are supposed to give you a little extra heart, a little extra emotion, but seem to me so artificial. And you lose that and your movie is automatically an hour shorter. And I think the lack of those extra subplots and extra characters makes the wave better. Now you.
One of the things that I liked about it is that there's no bad guy. And I like that for two reasons. I like it obviously from a sort of film criticism sort of reason. I like that this force of nature is the antagonist in the film, and you know, the family is struggling against nature, essentially. There's no sort of bad guy. Then there's no artificial, like, Oliver Platt character who's like, I'm going to, like, you know, yell and stomp my feet.
No, you're right.
This stuff.
You could see, though, as a writer, you could see how tempting it is to make, well, if something went wrong in that crevice and somebody, like, misrepresented the numbers to save his or her job, and, like, you could see how easy and tempting it is to make one of the characters evil, and then that evil character dies a brutal, ironic death, and yay!
Yeah,
but you're right. It's much more.
It's much subtler than that. You know, like there is a character who is sort of somewhat antagonistic. You know, a bit in those early scenes. You know, another scientist and the thing. But you know, the other reason why I like this is because from a scientific point of view, like obviously these guys are all there because they want to protect the town. This is why they do this job. It's why, you know, they're there in the first place. But they're then also put to this really, really difficult decision. So, you know, Christian comes up and he's like, oh, I think this wave is going to happen. And he tries to explain to the rest of the team why he thinks it's going to happen. And they kind of, they're a little bit skeptical. They think maybe it's because it's his last day, you know, but they're not like gaslighting him, treating him like he's crazy or whatever. But they sort of point out, like, we have to be sure before we sort of trip the alarm. And you really get a sense for that later on when they actually do hit the sirens and you realize, like, if they do that prematurely, even once, it will condition people to not pay attention to it when it really, really happens, and it could literally kill people. And so they have to be like, sure, really sure, sure. But at the same time, there's only a 10-minute window, so they have to get it as early as they possibly can once they know that it's real. And so that tension, you really feel that in those scenes where they're trying to decide whether or not to set off the alarm, and it feels very real to me.
I also like, I mentioned before that, you know, side characters doing kind things. And there are two characters left with the wife as she is trying to get all the people out of the hotel. And her son, who is a teenager, a moody teenager, he's skating around in the basement of the hotel. And she has to go find him. And these two tourists, a woman just hops off the bus to help her find her son. And her husband comes along reluctantly. And they both, like, you get, oh, I get it. You need body count. You need some side victims because a disaster movie is suspense. You need to have a couple people die here and there to keep the suspense and the tension percolating. But both of them go in interesting ways. They're not just afterthoughts, you know?
Yeah. And again, one of the things that the movie does well is it doesn't try to give them some sort of quirky personalities or some sort of, like, you know, character trait. Like, oh, well, I'm going to, like, they're just tourists. They're just people. They're just there. They're, you know, they feel real.
In the American version, she'd be like a 55-year-old brassy blonde, like chewing gum and, you know, with sunglasses. And he'd be like, yo, bro, let's go. And they'd be like ridiculous cliches. Here, they're just simple husband and wife. And I like the side characters in this movie. Steven, a science question, doctor. The sequence is the characters run back into the hotel. The wave is right behind them. It engulfs the entire hotel. You would assume that the wave is, you know, much higher than the hotel, so it fills the entire hotel with water. They manage to lock themselves in a bomb shelter that is half waterproof. And how long does it take for the water to recede?
I couldn't tell you off the top of my head. I think it depends a little bit on the geometry of the fjord, as well as the geometry of the hotel. You know, at that point in the movie, it cuts to black, and then it's a little bit later, so we don't know how much time has passed. But I mean, I can't imagine it's more than, you know, the same order of magnitude, only a couple minutes probably before the water starts to recede. And then obviously it's got to drain out of the hotel, and the hotel is not built to, like, for drainage, you know, for a completely filled hotel to drain. One of my only scientific nitpicks with this movie: when the hotel does drain and the father comes back and he starts looking for the mother and the son, there are little random fires just all over the place in the hotel.
Oh my God, right out in front. I noticed the exact same thing. There's one right, like bottom right. There's one middle left. And then there's one kind of center top.
Well, and then there's ones like in the hallway of the hotel as he's walking through it trying to find them. There's just like a couple of random fires. And I guess maybe the idea is that, like, when the water contacted the electrical system, it shorted something out and yada, yada, yada. But I mean, I think it's mostly a production design and lighting thing. They're like, oh, this looks kind of cool. But like that stuff's all wet. Like,
I thought a lot of the production design as he comes back into this town and he comes across some horrible things. I mean, I thought the scale of the destruction was pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, presumably they must have built, like, I don't know if they, you know, shot the early scenes in a real hotel and then built a set for the destroyed hotel. That would be my guess, probably, unless they built a set for the whole thing.
Oh, I even mean his trek to the hotel is a little 10-minute movie in itself.
Right, as he comes across the cars and he comes across the bus that's, you know, been turned over on its side. Yeah, no, I mean, again, the scale of all that destruction. And again, it shows how with smart filmmaking, you can stretch your budget. I mean, like, in a sense, right, this entire movie was built around the idea of this wave comes, you have, you know, 2 or 3 minutes of disaster, like CGI disaster, like whatever, and then you have the aftermath of the wave. And so the movie is almost divided neatly in the middle between this setup, and then the wave comes, and then you have the aftermath of the wave. And it's a clever way to sort of make a disaster movie that feels like it's on the scale of a big American disaster movie without having to necessarily spend the kind of money that you need to spend to make it a San Andreas. I mean, it's literally cost 30 times less than like San Andreas, and it's 30 times better.
I also think it's a testament to what editing does. This movie is cut. There's not an ounce of fat on this movie. There's a little bit of hallway wandering, which, you know, is like a metaphor of mine. It doesn't necessarily mean hallway wandering. It means just,
although,
you know,
in this case it does.
Yep. Just when a scene is just 45 seconds longer than it needs to be for whatever reason. And this movie is tight. It moves, you know, you're moving from, you know, set piece to set piece, character to character. And that keeps the tension moving as well.
So before we, you know, wrap up this segment, I do want to let everybody know, if you have not seen this movie, it is available right now, at least in the U.S., on Netflix. I would also highly encourage you to make sure that you watch the original Norwegian version with subtitles versus the dubbed version, which I found, I didn't watch the whole thing, but I found the parts that I watched very underwhelming in the dubbed version. So it's certainly one that you want to watch in the original language.
In 99 times out of 100, you want to always watch the film in its intended form. The only time maybe you don't is if it's a film you've seen many times and, hey, now I want to see the American version of Godzilla. That makes perfect sense. But anytime you're watching a film for the first time, my advice, and Steven, I think, would agree, watch it in its in original form, period.
Yeah, and I bring it up specifically because when I went to go play it on Netflix, it autoplayed the dubbed version. So I want to make sure everybody knows that the original Norwegian version is available on Netflix. You just have to change your settings to be able to see it that way.
Yep.
So.
Oh, and I'll throw in a plug. Also, you plugged Netflix. I'll plug Hulu because they have the sequel, which I'm about to watch in about 15 minutes.
Yeah, I got to see that in the theater again at Fantastic Fest this past year. And holy crap, it is every bit as white knuckle suspenseful as the original. And ooh, man, it's so good.
All right, report card for The Wave. As always, I will start because I am not the doctor. On a movie level, B+. It's very conventional. You know exactly where it's going. It doesn't really deviate from the conventional disaster movie formula, although it is written with some actual heart and character. So a solid B+. And as far as science goes, let's say A-. Steven?
I would give the movie an A, maybe an A-. I mean, man, rewatching it this week, it was almost as effective a second time on my computer as it was the first time in the theater. But man, if you have a chance to see this in the theater, take it, because it is an experience. So I would give it an A in the theater and maybe an A- on my computer. And for scientific veracity, like I said, I think, insofar as I don't know a lot of the nuances of geology, what I do know of physics and geology and science in general, I think it's very scientifically accurate. And so I think it deserves an A in that department as well.
All right. Well, thank you for tuning in to another episode of Science vs. Fiction. Well, hey, Steven, why don't you tell everybody about our brand new shiny Twitter account?
So you can find us on Twitter at SVF Podcast. We'll have links to the episodes, tidbits about the movies that we're watching, and also opportunities for you guys to give us some feedback on what kind of matchups you'd like to see for future episodes.
Yes, because Steven wants to do something horror-y, so maybe tell us what we should pair up with sci-fi horror or sci-fi comedy. We are definitely going to do Galaxy Quest, but we're not sure what to pair it up with. So there you go. Thank you.
Thank you guys so much.
Hey, all, thanks for listening. We really hope you enjoyed Science vs. Fiction. Hey, Steven, you know what people can do if they want to support the show?
No, Scott, why don't you tell me what people can do if they want to support the show?
Well, there are many several awesome things that you could do. Leave us a review at iTunes, or tweet about us, or Facebook about us, or email your mom and tell her that this is the best podcast ever. You could also sign up for our Patreon account, which will give you bonus episodes like commentaries, interviews, and random fun stuff for nerds. So thanks for listening. I also did want to compliment Oliver Platt on playing the most ridiculously inconsistent character I've ever seen.
Who's right half the time? He's the villain.
He starts out right like a rotten dick. He's a rotten dick, and then he's a completely noble hero, and then he wants to kill countless people at the end. I don't understand
but he's
him.
Right. He's totally right. That's the thing I love about this, is that the movie codes Chiwetel as being like the hero and Oliver as being the villain, but almost everything Oliver Platt says is like, yeah, hey, the entire species is at stake here. A couple of hundred people on this platform, like literally billions of people just died. Those couple of hundred people, like, yeah, it sucks, but like we need to, you know, survival of the species is more important. And he's totally right about that. But yet you root against him because he's an asshole.
There's a scene towards the end where he's the only one standing in the way to open the door and let thousands of people, poor people, come in. And then they obviously end up letting all the poor workers in.
And then the ship almost gets destroyed as a result. So he was right.
Right, right. But. How are you going to feed all those extra people? Are you kidding?
Exactly. He said that. He made that point, too. He's like, we have limited resources. And Chiwetel's like, well, we can't. We got to be human beings and blah, 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 blah.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.